Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 17. I will entitle this chapter, Job Continues. Where then is my hope? In our last chapter, chapter 17, Job has started on another discourse. He blasts his false friends. He says, miserable comforters are you. And of course, we're in the middle of this cycle of debate between Job's three false friends and himself. We've already gone through discourses by Eliphaz first, then Bildad the Shuhite second, and then third, Zophar the Naamathite third, and then we've rolled back around to Eliphaz as he gives another screed against poor old Job. So it's somewhat repetitious, but the repetition drives home the basic point. Job is hopeless. He cannot understand why he's suffering so much. Why has God let him down? He knows God is just, and he knows that he has not done anything to earn God's anger, and yet God is angry at him, and nobody will explain it to him. And all of his friends, all they can say is, it's because you sinned, Job. And Job said, no, I didn't. I didn't sin. Yes, you did, Job. That's basically the nub of it. So we start down Job 17, verses 1 through 3. Job continues, my spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. Lay down now a pledge for me with yourself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? Now when Job says in verse 1, his spirit is broken, the KJV says, my breath is corrupt. John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown take that to mean that Job's breath smelled bad because of his disease. Citing Job 19:17, my breath is offensive to my wife, Job says, and I am loathsome to my own brothers. Well, that's pretty literal. My breath is corrupt. But as the NIV puts it, as well as NASB, and Adam Clark agrees with this, he's talking about his spirit. His spirit is broken. He's just beat down. He's whipped. My days are extinguished. That means his life is about over with, and he doesn't care anymore. The grave is ready for me. I'm ready to die. John Gill says that when Job says his spirit is broken, it could be that it means Job was drawing every breath in pain. Well, I'm sure he was. Whether that's what the phrase means or not, I'm sure Job was drawing every breath in pain. He's absolutely miserable. And then he says in verse 2, surely mockers are with me. Those mockers are his three false friends who are supposed to be comforting him. Instead, they're making fun of him, saying he's a sinner. Job says, my eye gazes on their provocation. They're provoking him. They're not comforting him. And then in verse 3, I'm assuming this is spoken to God. Lay down now a pledge for me with yourself, Job says. Yourself is capitalized in the NASB, showing that it refers to God. So Job is saying, lay down a pledge for me, God. What does he mean by that? Well, John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown take it to mean, I guess the most obvious thing it could mean is, Job wants a pledge from God. As the NIV Study Bible agrees, saying this, quote, Job wanted God to be his guarantee of security. Certainly none of Job's friends would guarantee his innocence. Job wanted assurance that ultimately he would be vindicated. As he saw his life ebbing away, he became desperate for some word of affirmation from God. And I think that's straightforward. However, Adam Clark says that Job is not asking for a pledge from God. He's asking for a pledge from his false friends. Lay down a pledge for me with yourself, meaning Eliphaz and company. Clark puts it this way, quote, deposit a pledge, stake your conduct against mine, and your life and soul on the issue. Let the cause come before God. Let him try it, and see whether any of you shall be justified by him, while I am condemned. Now, this pledge is referring to a legal procedure. As Jameson Fawcett and Brown say, that parties to litigation had to both lay down a security before the trial, both the plaintiff and the defendant. The plaintiff's security would compensate a defendant for a bogus complaint, and the defendant's security would guarantee compensation for an aggrieved plaintiff. In case the plaintiff's case turned out to be just, he wouldn't have to worry about collecting his judgment. The money would already be there. Sounds like a great idea, really, for modern jurisprudence, but we don't do that, at least not in the States. Basically, Job is asking for a pledge that he is not guilty, that somebody will pay him off once he proves his innocence. I will mention the NIV here, which translates this verse 3 as the pledge you demand. Lay down now the pledge you demand. Well, all the other translations have Job demanding the pledge, not God demanding the pledge. How is God demanding a pledge? Seems to me like Job is the one asking for a pledge for himself, so I don't understand the NIV translation. So we're going to take it in a straightforward manner. Job is looking for assurance, and he doesn't have it. We go now to Job 17, verses 4 through 5. For you have kept their heart from understanding. Job is continuing to speak. He's speaking to God. The you there is capitalized in the NASB. For you have kept their heart, God, from understanding. Their meaning the false friends. Therefore you will not exalt them. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also will languish. In verse 4, Job says that God will not exalt his false friends. What Job could be meaning there is that God will not exalt his friends to be a surety in Job's case. You're not going to let them guarantee the outcome. Or most probably, it's you, God, will not exalt the three false friends to be a judge in Job's case. So Job is saying, you're not going to exalt them. They're not going to judge me. Now, what Job predicts here comes to pass because we read in Job 42, verse 7, it came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. So Job was vindicated. He needed surety that he would be vindicated. He didn't get it, but he was vindicated at the end. He takes another shot at Eliphaz and company. In verse 5, Job says, he who informs against friends for a share of the spoil. He's, of course, referring to his false friends. The NIV has, he who denounces his friends. So Job is complaining that his friends have denounced him before God, which they have done. They've accused him of being a sinner, somebody who's done some horrible secret sin. Now the KJV, which translation I don't trust too much, but they have verse 5 translated this way, he who speaketh flattery to his friends for a share of the spoil. If that were the proper translation, Job would be saying that the friends, the false friends, promised prosperity to Job if Job would just confess his alleged sin. Or it could be that the friends are trying to flatter God by upholding God's holiness. These false friends speak flattery. Well, I think all that's a stretch. I think the modern translations have it right. He who informs or denounces his friend for a share of his spoil is a bad person. And as a result of his bad acting, the eyes of his children also will languish, fail for want of substance. The NIV actually has fail. And that means his children are going to die. And back then, it was a big deal if your inheritance prospered or didn't prosper. Not so much of a big deal today. Now, when Job predicts that his tormentors will have children who will not prosper, Job is answering Eliphaz's taunt concerning the death of Job's children. In Job 5, verse 4, Eliphaz is speaking, and he says this, his children are far from safety, and they are crushed in the gate. Neither is there any to deliver them. Talking about an unrighteous person, which he accuses Job of being, he says, look at your children, they're gone. Job says, well, what about your children, Eliphaz? They're not going to make it either. God's not going to exalt you, and he's going to let the eyes of your children languish, fail. Now, I said this was a big deal back in the Old Testament about what happens to you children. All of this is in accord with the Old Testament dispensation of legal retribution, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown puts it. Let's read Exodus 25. You shall not worship them or serve them, the false gods, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. Now, of course, the inevitable question arises, well, that's not fair. The third and fourth generation didn't do anything. Well, no, this assumes they do the same thing that the parent generation does, and they get punished for their own sins. We go to Job 17, verses 6 through 9. Job continues, but he, that's capital H-E, so I'm referring this to God, but he has made me a byword of the people, Job says. God has made me a byword of the people, and I am one at whom men spit. My eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow. The upright will be appalled at this, and the innocent will stir up himself against the godless. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will grow stronger and stronger. Now, he has made me a byword of the people. That could refer to Eliphaz, but most probably it's God. The NIV, the NASB say it's God, so it's God. God has made me a byword. Well, that's true even to this day. We talk about the patience of Job using the old-fashioned King James English. the endurance of Job would be more modern English. Everybody knows about Job. So he is a byword amongst the people 4,000 years later. But there's a difference now. The patience of Job or the endurance of Job is considered to be a good thing. But Job is talking about his name has become a proverb as somebody who's pitiful and sinful and weak and worthless and despised. Job says in verse 6, I am one at whom men spit. The NIV translates it, a man in whose face people spit. That's pretty bad. Somebody's lying in misery there, scraping his balls, and you're going to go spit in his face. That's what he feels like. People don't care about him. I mean, the pain that this man is going through, I don't think anybody can really feel it, not just by reading about it. Job says in verse 7, my eye has also grown dim because of grief through excessive weeping and abundance of tears. Cried so much, John Gill says, he almost lost his eyesight. Now, I think that's metaphorical. I never heard of anyone losing their eyesight from crying too much. But Clark says continual weeping impairs the sight. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. Adam Clark, 19th century Clark, knows everything. This idea of your eye wasting away because of grief, because of crying, becoming dim because of crying, is reflected in Psalm 6, verse 7. My eye has wasted away with grief. It has become old because of all my adversaries. Verse 7, Job says, all my members are as a shadow. He was nothing but skin and bone. He looked like a ghost. He's wasting away physically. Verse 9, Job says, nevertheless, the righteous will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will grow stronger and stronger. Job still maintains his innocence. He has not done anything to deserve all this suffering. He doesn't care what his idiot friends are telling him. He doesn't care that God has not revealed to him the reason for all this. He doesn't understand the reason, but one thing he does know, he did not do anything wrong. He says the righteous will hold to his way. He's referring to himself as being righteous. He says he who has clean hands will grow stronger and stronger. He's referring to himself as one who has clean hands, and he will grow stronger and stronger in his case of innocence. Now, I skipped verse 8 here. Let me read verse 8 for you. The upright will be appalled at this, appalled at his suffering, his eyes growing dim because of grief. His members are but a shadow. The upright will be appalled at this, and the innocent will stir up himself against the godless. It's ambiguous as to who Job is referring to here. Is he talking about the true upright, people who really understand suffering? People like Job? Let's assume that for the moment. The upright, true righteous people who understand suffering will be appalled at what's happened to Job. And the innocent will stir up himself against the godless. The innocent people who understand true suffering will stir themselves up against godless people like Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite. These righteous people who understand suffering will be appalled that a good man like Job could suffer so much and then be rebuked so by his so-called friends. Adam Clark agrees with that. He says, quote, Job is supposed to speak prophetically of his future restoration and of the good which religious society should derive from the history of his original affluence, consequent poverty and affliction, and final restoration to health, peace, and prosperity. The upright will receive the account with astonishment and wonder at the dispensations of the Almighty, while hypocrites, false professors, and the sour-headed godly, shall be unmasked. That's spoken in an ironic fashion, the sour-headed godly. They shall be unmasked, and innocent men, whether in affliction or affluence, shall be known to be favorites of the Almighty. So in other words, Clark is agreeing here with the idea that Job is confidently predicting the upright are going to be appalled and will be innocent, and they will be stirred up against the godless, people like Eliphaz and his two friends, and people will understand Job's suffering. Well, if that's true, then Job sure was confident about the future in the midst of his horrible suffering. It very well could be that in the midst of all of his pain, he had a kernel of faith to believe that God was going to vindicate him eventually. Now, it could be that in verse 8, the upright will be appalled at this, that Job is not talking about the true upright. He's talking about the fake upright. Self-righteous people who don't understand suffering, as the NIV Study Bible suggests, these people would stir themselves up against those they thought were godless, like Job. They erroneously thought were godless, like Job, who was suffering for no apparent reason. If we read it that way, then Job is saying, the fake upright, people like you, Eliphaz, and friends, you will be appalled at what I'm going through. And the reason you will be appalled at what I'm going through is because you think I'm guilty. If we take it that way, we have a problem, because the very next phrase in verse 8 says, the innocent will stir up himself against the godless. Well, you would have to take the innocent, meaning innocent in their own eyes, the fake upright people, will stir up himself against the godless, against people like Job who are suffering. Well, I guess that makes sense if you take it that way. The NIV Study Bible seems to believe that Job is talking about fake righteous people, not true righteous people. And I don't agree with this. I think Job was talking about true righteous people. But the NIV Study Bible says this, quote, the suffering of righteous people can cause others to wonder what might befall them. They can become indignant. Such suffering violates their theology. Good people are blessed. Wicked people are punished. That's the simple theology. Their bewilderment was partly due to the physical horror of Job's suffering and partly due to their confusion of how they thought life was supposed to work. Well, the NIV Study Bible just thinks that Job is talking about the false upright people will be appalled at somebody suffering like Job because there must be sin involved. And the fake innocent, the wrongly believed innocent people will stir themselves up against who they think to be godless. I don't know. I think it's just easier to say that. No, Job says, no, the true upright people are going to prevail in all this. Sooner or later, they're going to stir themselves up against godless people like Eliphaz. Now, if that's true, Job really did have a lot of faith in the midst of all of his grief. And I think that makes sense, because in verse 9, Job does show faith. He says, the righteous will hold to his way. He who has clean hands will grow stronger and stronger. So we're going to take it that way. Job is expressing some hope here in the midst of all of his doom and gloom. Well, going along with the idea that the righteous will hold to his way, Job is sort of an object lesson for righteous people who hold to their integrity in the midst of suffering. As Adam Clark puts it, the book of Job has, quote, ever been the great textbook of godly men in a state of persecution and affliction. This is what Job seems prophetically to declare. And I think that's what he's doing. He's saying, righteousness is going to win out here. It might not look like it, but it's going to happen. We go now to Job 17, verses 10 through 16, and we will finish this chapter. Job is now speaking to the three false friends, and he says, but come again, all of you now, for I do not find a wise man among you. My days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. They make night into day, saying the light is near in the presence of darkness. If I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. If I call to the pit, you are my father, to the worm, my mother and my sister. Where now is my hope? And who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down into the dust? All Job can see now is the grave. He sees no hope. He just expressed some hope, but that's long off into the future. He doesn't think that he's going to see it. Job continues to lay scorn on the three false friends, and that makes me glad that he did that, because they deserved it. If I do not find a wise man among you, well, no, sir, they were fools. Then Job says, well, verse 11, my days are past, my plans are torn apart. In other words, he has no hope. No hope for the future. As John Gill says, quote, Job doubtless had formed in his mind great designs of good things, natural, civil, and religious, concerning the enlargement of his temporal estate, the settlement of his children in the world, making provision for the poor, supporting and enlarging the interest of true religion, the reformation of his heathenish neighbors, and the spread of divine truths among them. When people have a goal in life, when they see something in the future that they can do good, they can live. But boy, when hope is extinguished, they might as well die. Job has relapsed to his state of gloom, as Adam Clark says. Verse 8 that we just read was a prediction of his ultimate triumph. The upright will be appalled at all what has happened to Job. The innocent will stir up himself against the godless. That was the ultimate deliverance that Job expected, but that's only ultimately. Penultimately, Sheol, the grave, is facing him. Verse 12, Job says of his three false friends, they make night into day, saying the light is near. What they were saying is, if you just repent, Job, then all this stuff would go away. This bad stuff would quit happening to you, and good things would happen. The nighttime will turn into day. They keep saying that in the presence of darkness, and Job says, yeah, you keep saying that, but I don't see any daytime. All I see is darkness. Verse 13, if I look for Sheol, of course Sheol is the Hebrew word for grave. If I look for the grave as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. Well, that if there's probably sense, I'm looking for Sheol as my home. I'm looking at darkness as my future. If or since I call to the pit, you are my father. The pit can be translated as corruption, as the KJV and the NIV have it. If I call to corruption, you are my father. What could that mean? Well, it could mean the grave, where dead bodies cause corruption, just a repetition of what he said about Sheol. Or it could be he's calling to his own corruption, the pus, etc., in his boils and ulcers. Or it could be he's calling to the corruption of his own dead body, as John Gill suggests, which he contemplated would appear very soon. Or it could just be he's appealing to the pit of Sheol, the grave, as a matter of repetition here. And since he is calling to the pit, you are my father, that if there, it really means since. And if he calls to the worm, my mother and my sister, well, your mother and your sister are your closest nurturing female relatives. And he treats the worms that crawl through a corpse as his closest comforting relatives. That's poetic. That's disgusting. So if your mother or sister is the worm that's going to run through your corpse, where now is my hope? Well, it's gone. Who regards my hope? Does anybody see it? No, it's gone. Will my hope go down with me to Sheol? No, there's no hope in Sheol. The grave is the grave. It's over. Again, this is not talking about the resurrection of the dead. This is talking about life looked at from this earthly vantage point. Shall we together, I and my hope, go down into the dust? Well, that's what's going to happen. Here's what Jomison, Fawcett, and Brown says about this quote. Job himself, though sometimes strongly confident, is often harassed with doubts and fears upon the subject, insomuch that his sayings and experience often appear contradictory. Now, I think I've pointed that out as we go through. Sometimes Job seems like he has faith in God, and sometimes he feels like he doesn't have faith in God. And the way I keep it straight is he never questioned the ultimate justice of God. What he did question was, is why isn't God telling him why he's suffering? Which is two different things. And it's easy to get those two things confused, and then you start thinking, well, Job's speaking with a forked tongue here. No, he wasn't. Once you realize what he's doing and how he's thinking, all of these chapters in Job make perfect sense with not a lot of trouble. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished Job chapter 17. We are now prepared to go to Job 18, verses 1 through 21. I will entitle that chapter, Bildad Speaks, God Punishes the Wicked. Bildad's not going to change his tune. Same old, same old. I hope you stay tuned to listen to Bildad bloviate a little bit in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.